The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Now, how's the volume for you? Is it a little bit lower? Yeah, a little bit lower. It's a little bit high. So how's that now? Is it better now? Okay. So, well, some of you come regularly will notice that there's a few unusual things here, if you're observant. So I don't know if you know, but this was all a surprise for me on Saturday, and it's a tree, and it was put up there because I thought we were kind of celebrating my 25 years of teaching here for this community, but also the 25 years of this community growing. And so one way to celebrate that was someone painted this tree, and then in the course of the Saturday evening, some 30 people came up and talked about the different programs that had sprung up blossomed out of the tree of IMC. And so all those flowers have little labels next to them about different programs that have started over these years, and it was quite touching to see it. And then kind of a subgroup of IMC, as part of the celebration, they gave IMC that Buddha. So we have a new Buddha. I don't know if you remember the old one already. And we had the one we had before was very nice because it was a gift from a friend who's a Dharma teacher. I don't ever want to buy a Buddha statue. Somehow it doesn't seem right to buy one. So this teacher gave us one. And for many years I was very happy to have it, but they never kind of felt like the right one for us. But I wasn't going to buy one. So I just waited for years. And years, so something would happen. And then on Saturday something happened. And now I have a new Buddha. And then, I don't know, could you show, Alfonso, can you get that, the key? And some of you might, then there was this surprise, all these surprises for me. And so I was given a golden key. You see? And I'd never been given a golden key. And so part of what happened behind my back was... I try to teach people to be up front. And what do I get? And so there was enough money raised to pay off the mortgage for the property we bought next to the retreat center, to expand the retreat center a little bit. And that was kind of the whole thing was a surprise because it only came on the market 15 months ago, and we had no money to buy it and didn't think it was possible. But it was so close to the meditation hall, we thought, well, if the local, I don't know, rock and roll, teenage motorcycle gang, meat-eating, barbecuing, wonderful neighbors came in, we would have to work on seeing the wonderfulness of of all that as we sit in our, you know. And so there was a little concern we had about the ambience of our very quiet place. And anyway, amazingly, in a matter of 15 months, the funds appeared and a lot of people support. And so one of the very nice things about that Saturday party was that, you know, to represent that it had been paid off, I was given the key to the house. And it said, if you can't read this, it says, paid in full with gratitude from the multitudes. So that was nice. And one of the things that was discussed during the course of these celebrations was the idea of having a vision. And so I thought I would talk a little bit about having a vision. And turns out the idea of having vision is a very important part of our Buddhist tradition. And it says, it's a, and it appears in very important teachings together with another word. In fact, in these ancient languages, sometimes two words come together, you can't tell if they're two words or, you know, there's no hyphens. You know. And so the words that usually in English we say, knowledge and vision, nana dasana. And so at some point as practice matures, people acquire knowledge and vision, and a variety of different kinds of knowledge and vision. And the knowledge is to realize something, to understand something, not in the abstract because you've read a book, because you know for yourself. You really know something. And then, but with that comes a vision, an act of imagination, an act of projecting into the future, of what this realization can mean if it was fully inhabited, fully lived, fully matured, fully flowered in one's life. So, for example, in very simple terms, if you go around at work all the time being tense or being afraid, and then one day, for some reason, you are not tense or afraid at work, and now you know something that you didn't know before. You knew that you don't have to be afraid at work. There's another option. And then you have, you could say, well, I knew it was possible that day, September 31st, 2015, it was possible that day, never again. It was just, you know, these Buddhists say, stay in the present, don't look in the future, just be here. So that, I guess that was done. But in fact, looking into the future is a very important part of human life and important part of Buddhist practice. And so the vision part would be, oh, if this was possible today, I can now imagine that this is possible in the future. Not only that, I can imagine now that there's a path and a way that maybe I can live my life at work someday without any fear or any tension. And so sometimes we have these realizations, understanding something shifts inside of us, and we know a possibility we didn't know before, but we know it so strongly that it brings with it a vision. If this could be complete, this can be really, you know, this can be expanded into the rest of my life. So, for example, it's possible to realize some degree of love, of compassion. And maybe because you, another person or a group of people, a certain situation. And from that, to realize, you know, this compassion, it doesn't have to be limited to this person or this situation. There's a capacity of compassion in this heart. And now I have a vision. I would like to live from there. I don't know how I'm going to do it. I know it's going to be hard. But I have a vision that this theoretically is possible. And I think I'm going to dedicate myself to let that grow and develop. Or it's possible that you have something that you're attached to. Maybe you don't even know you're attached to it. Sometimes some of our deepest attachments, we don't even know they're there. But then maybe in the course of meditation practice or mindfulness practice, you relax a fair amount and you encounter this place of attachment, and temporarily you let go of it. And the peace, the well-being, the spaciousness that you experience is unprecedented. You've never had it before. And then it becomes kind of, you know, then you have a, you know a possibility that you didn't know before. And maybe it was just very meaningful to have that peace or that sense of well-being. And then there's a vision. I think I can, you know, this is something that I would like to expand and fill out and grow into. And that gives the human life a sense of purpose. This is what I want to do for my life. Maybe it's, you know, what you want to do somewhat. There's other things that are important. Or it's something you want to give yourself over totally. And in Buddhist circles, it's not uncommon that people... Some people will experience something, some kind of peace, well-being, wholeness, healing, love, compassion, something that is so compelling, feels like it's so much kind of wells up inside, and it has so much goodness to it, or so much rightness to it, and it's so much better than the alternative, that it becomes clear, this, I want my life to be based on this. And some people go so far and say, this is more important than many of the conventional things our society holds up as being the purpose of life, or what we should be concerned with. So, you know, certainly the pursuit of money. Certainly the pursuit of money for money's sake. Sometimes the pursuit of fame, the pursuit of material well-being, the pursuit of, you know, many things. In fact, people who become Buddhist monastics make a choice not to engage in romantic relationships, which for some people is very, very important. And some of the people I know who become monastics are not troubled or aversive to being in relationships, but they feel that what they're experiencing, what they know in some deep, abiding way, is so rich and so meaningful that they have no interest or doesn't to be involved in romantic relationships. They feel so fulfilled. And some of the ones I know, a few of the really great monastics I know, they are not recluses. Some of them are gregarious and with tremendous, rich, warm relationships to hundreds of people. It's quite impressive. If you ever have been around, there's a monk who used to be here in California named Ajahn Amaro. I mean, that guy loves to talk. And he's eloquent, and he's engaging, and he's personable, and he has deep relationships with so many people, but he has no romantic relationship. Has he lost out on something important? Maybe. But anyway, he has a sense of fulfillment. So anyway, the point I'm trying to make is that there's some things that in a conventional society we say as being important, but some people find that there's a state of being, a way of being in the world that bubbles up from the heart or the chest or in the mind or somewhere that feels so right, is so fulfilling, gives such a sense of purpose and meaning to life, is so phenomenally healing, creates a sense of tremendous sense of belonging in this world. For me, the world became my home as my practice matured. As opposed to being alienated from the world, I feel that this is the home, wherever I am. You know, here I am. And so there's some shift. So for me, in my own practice, there were a series of things that happened that I knew something that I didn't know before. And that became, I then had a vision of having that grow. The first one that I can remember that was quite important for me in meditation practice was I was meditating twice a day in college. And in the course of those months that I first started meditating, I experienced a sense of, back then I called it integrity, a sense of integrity. My mind was still, I hadn't gotten any instruction. I was doing Zen practice, so there's no instruction. And I knew very little about Buddhism, so I didn't have any idea that meditation was about not thinking. So I didn't think I was supposed to stop my thinking when I was meditating, so I was thinking happily along. But it wasn't a problem for me, because no one told me it should be a problem. But I would sit there and just be present for what was. I'd try to be my breath a little bit, and be present just for what was. Being present for what was is very different than being lost in what was, or being, you know, caught up or reactive to what is. So it was very different than how I usually live my life, to just be there present for what was. In the course of doing that, I felt this integrity, maybe a sense of wholeness or completeness or lack of conflict, maybe. But I called it integrity. And that was very, very meaningful for me. So meaningful for me that I decided that not to go further in meditation. I didn't have any idea that, you know, more meditation would do something, but rather I had this idea that now I want to learn how to expand that sense of integrity in the rest of my life. Why should I only have integrity when I meditate? You know, that should be of interest elsewhere too, right, the rest of my life. So one of the reasons I then went to live at a Buddhist center was not to meditate more, but rather to find a community of people where I can explore and experiment with how to kind of let this kind of, what I was discovering in meditation, live out in my daily life as well. But the thing about going to live in a Buddhist community is there's more meditation. And the more I meditated, the more I wanted to kind of, the more I had this vision of a possibility of being more whole, more connected, more peaceful, more at ease. And so, well, where can I do this even better? So then I went from to the monastery. And then after in the monastery for a while, I went to Japan. And then to Japan, I went to Thailand and Burma. And I had this vision of something was possible. And then when I my first long retreat in Thailand, I experienced a level of inner stillness that I had never had before. And it became, I had a knowledge of something, inner stillness or peace. And then I had a vision of what it would be like to really stay in that peace or be connected to it in a bigger way. And so then I went back to Asia a second time to somehow touch into that realm, that dimension again. So this idea of knowledge and vision. One of the things that I had knowledge and vision of came as a kind of a little bit of a lightning bolt was I was doing walking meditation in Burma, and I was feeling pretty happy. There was a fair amount of joy as I was walking, and I thought, and I had this thought that when I'm mindful, when I'm really mindful of something, in the act of mindfulness, the moment of mindfulness, there's a freedom. There's freedom from what I know. Rather than being entangled, there's a freedom. There's a kind of independence, clear recognition, clear mindfulness. It means you're not entangled or in veils or resisting what is. You're just there with it, and there's freedom in it. And I had little experience tastes of this, and I knew, oh, in a moment of mindfulness, clear mindfulness, there's freedom. But the important thing, the next thing I thought, and this is where the vision came up, because I knew that, but then I had the vision. And that made me really happy. And the vision the realization was, it's possible to be, it's theoretically possible to be mindful of every experience I have. No matter what it is, it's possible to bring mindfulness to it. And then I realized, wow, that means it's possible theoretically to be free in every possible human experience I find myself in. And that really made me happy. I couldn't do it. But just knowing that, it's having that vision, having that imagination, that sense of a possibility, really fueled me, really inspired me, and kind of gave me a lot of confidence in doing the practice. So the sense of a vision, using your imagination, looking into the future, providing you a sense of purpose based on what you really know. And the mindfulness practice is one of those things that's meant to bring you something that you know deeply yourself. And it can be as simple as knowing that you're really holding on tight to something, and you let go of it, and you see that, wow, clinging sucks. I didn't know that. I thought it was like the point. And letting go feels really right. And for me, I also, one of the things that I came to know through practice was I got to know love, compassion in a way that I'd never known it before. And one of the visions I had from that that was very important for me was the idea that of expanding and universalizing that. I thought, but why should I just love some people? The heart has this capacity for love, for compassion. Well, let me now kind of see if I can open up and spread it out and so I can include more people in that heart, more and more people. I'm still working on it. But it really has inspired me, because I felt so right. It felt so good to have this kind of warmth and for people. And so then it's been now, you know, for the last 35 years or so, maybe more, I've been kind of part of my practice is to try to keep that those channels open, or discover how to open them, and try to make it more and more expanded to include more people in it. And it's been a great path to do that. And I wouldn't have done that if I didn't think I had, if I didn't have a vision that it was possible, that it was worthwhile. There's an analogy that I like to give for to get a sense of the Buddha's, or at least the archetype of the Buddha as a fully liberated person. And maybe some of you heard this before, because I like teaching it, so I apologize for repeating myself. It's an occupational hazard of teachers. After 25 years, you'd think I'd repeat myself sometimes. We used to rent the community center in Portola Valley, and then on Sunday mornings for our Sunday morning sittings, and it had a kind of a old linoleum floor with square foot tiles, and it was mostly an open floor, and we'd had Sunday morning sitting, and sometimes the Portola Valley rented out their community center for parties Saturday night. And sometimes we'd come in there early Sunday morning for our sittings, and we would take off our shoes at the door and walk in barefoot onto this linoleum floor where it was really sticky from the beer and the whatever went on there that was spilled on the floor. It hadn't been cleaned yet. So I thought about that for a while and thought, well, what if for 500 years no one ever cleaned that linoleum floor? Lots of parties, lots of dust, and lots of stuff. 500 years. And they danced on it and walked on it and did all the stuff on it. And so that it got really pressed in really good. It gets hot, people walk on it, gets pressed in, and it gets like almost like becomes like marble. It's like really, you know, and maybe even shiny oil, feet oil, and it gets really shiny and polished. And it's, you know, and but it's like 3-4 feet deep. And someday, someone goes to the archives, Portola Valley, and there's a record, crinkled old paper, that says, and the people that kind of don't remember what paper is, but this guy's kind of an archaeologist, and so you might, there's papers, what you're supposed to read paper. So it finds this piece of paper, and it says, and there's a linoleum floor. And people say, and he goes around and says, there's a linoleum floor, you know that. You know what a linoleum is? No, maybe it's special. No, there's no linoleum floor there. You're crazy. It's just beautiful, you know, gunk. But he said, no, it says here. No, there can't be. It's impossible. Well, this person perseveres and gets out of jackhammer and spends a few months or years, because it's really hard, and you know, digs down through that floor that's built up. And eventually gets to the bottom and is able to clear out 1 square foot of the linoleum. And the person realizes, yes, there's a linoleum. And then the person knows, or assumes, or has a vision, chances are, if this is I managed to clear it this square foot, now I know that the whole floor is probably linoleum. And it's possible to clear all the gunk away and come back to this beautiful linoleum floor that was there 500 years ago. If he has enough time, she has enough time to clear it out, then maybe, you know, theoretically, the linoleum could all be cleared out. So it's possible in a person's Buddhist practice, it is possible to get down to the linoleum. What an analogy for enlightenment. And know that there's a square foot of the mind or the heart that can be polished, or is the floor of it, which is beautiful. And then the Buddha represents the theoretical possibility that given enough time and practice, your whole linoleum floor can be cleared. And I don't know if I have the enough time in my lifetime to do it all, but I know, you know, there's a vision and a direction to go in life. Yes, it's worthwhile. And so from the depth of my practice, I've learned of a possibility. And that possibility guides my life. It gives it a sense of purpose and direction and feels like it's immensely valuable for myself and for our society. So then I've devoted myself to sharing this with people and teaching it to people. And so I started 25 years ago. I was invited to join the group that became IMC. It met in Palo Alto. And I was asked to lead it in 1990. It was about 12, 15 people who came. And the end of August in 1990, I gave my first Vipassana Dharma talk there. And I was a student at Stanford. And what was interesting for me was that, and I said this on Saturday, some of you may have heard it, that I had grown up in my Buddhist life in a Buddhist culture where you weren't supposed to teach the Buddhism, teach Buddhism, people the Dharma or anything, unless they asked you. That was kind of like how it was done. And in fact, the old, really old lore is they have to ask three times. So that, you know, you certainly don't go and say, I want to teach something. You know, that's kind of, in the old school, that's not considered appropriate to go and, you know, I want to teach something. Can I be a teacher? You just don't do that. You wait till you're invited. So I kind of grew up in that old system. So I was kind of operating on that when I was asked to kind of take over the group, and I kind of was assumed, like, well, there, I'm here out of invitation. And I'll just, well, if they want me to come, I'll give a talk. But after a while, I realized that it was kind of a fiction, or it was kind of like I had been invited to lead the group. So they were waiting for me to, you know. But what I realized was, and I realized part of it in retrospect, so after some time of being teaching Monday nights, I saw that these people are, their practice is coming along, they're serious, they're good practitioners, and I had a vision for them, a vision of how they can grow in their practice. And the vision was, let's have a one-day sitting, a one-day retreat. And some of them had never heard of one-day retreats. And I saw it was my job to see that, you know, what was possible beyond what they knew and open the door, create the opportunity for them to step into that. So we did that. And then after a while I thought, you know, there are people who don't really know how to meditate here who come regularly. I had a vision of teaching them how to meditate better. And so I thought, well, let's have an intro class. So I proposed we have an intro class. And then at some point they had practiced further, and after a few years, that these people are ready for a residential retreat. And they go, what's a residential retreat? Well, we'll rent the facilities up on Skyline and go up there for the weekend and practice all day, and, you know, for 2-3 days, and it'll be great. And they said, okay. And so then I knew this possibility. So my job, because I was a little bit ahead of them down the path, I knew what's possible, a little bit about how it's possible, how to grow. And so I had these visions. This is possible. And so as the group grew and grew, slowly dawned on me that it was part of my role is to have a vision, have visions for what's possible, and to point to that as possible. Because I knew something was possible. And so at some point in 1996 or so, I started realizing how meaningful it would be, how important it would be for the continued growth of the individuals and the community if we had our own place. Because we were renting. We had, at some point we were renting, in the course of any given month, we might be renting from 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different places. We would rent around and we'd carry our zafus around and stuff and bells and, you know, and here and there. And then I used to do, in Palo Alto, back when we were in Palo Alto days, people would want to come and talk to me about their practice. So I'm happy to talk with them. So I would meet with them in the good weather. I'd meet with them in the parks in Palo Alto. We'd sit under, you know, just because I didn't have an office. You know, where am I going to meet them? So, but then when the winter time, when I got to be, you know, didn't work to be in the parks anymore, I would meet with people at Cafe Verona. I don't know if it's still there in Palo Alto. Is it still there, Cafe Verona? Yeah, still there. And so yeah, I would meet, you know, have these, you know, interviews, you know, these, you know, close, like doing therapy, maybe like, you know, at Cafe Verona. And people would talk to me, and some people would be crying. You know, it's a little, you know, unusual place. But we didn't have an, you know, I didn't have an office, you know, so we just, so the idea was to put it all under one roof. But so, partly because I saw how valuable it would be for people to have a kind of a spiritual home. Something different happens when you have a place and it's steady and consistent and it's a place. So that was a vision. And so as things have grown, it's felt appropriate to have a further vision for the vision. I feel it's been part of my job. So I know something, knowledge, and then I have a vision. And what I've tried to do is to do that without ambition. And hopefully I've done that well enough. Because I think that there's a great saying that about Buddhist teachers that you should always keep in mind. Hold me accountable to this and other teachers. A teacher who wants something is dangerous. Mm. Isn't that nice? So, you know, maybe you have to kind of, wanting is a strange word, but, you know, I certainly wanted many things, but it wasn't required, it wasn't needed. So it was kind of more kind of relaxed, and if it happens, it'd be great. But you have to have the vision. And then one of the big visions that happened recently was, you know, by having the retreat center. And now we have our own residential retreat center. And now I have a key. Golden key. That wasn't my vision, to have a golden key. So I offer these words to you today partly to give context to what you see here today. It's not going to stay up here, but so you get some, oh, there's pictures against the wall over there. Wonderful pictures. There's old, and I was surprised by some of the pictures they gathered together from the, you know, some time ago. And a wonderful series of black and white photos which were commemorating. In June, we had a retreat at the retreat center in Spanish, for a Spanish-speaking community. And the year before and this year was the first time west of the Mississippi, maybe the only second time ever in the United States that it's been an insight meditation retreat offered in Spanish. And so, you know, it's such a wonderful thing. And so they wanted to have to show the pictures to commemorate my 25 years. That made me happy. And old pictures of this church. And when this was a church, you can see it was called Christ Church. There was a sign on the sidewalk. And other things. So you can walk if you want to see one of our early budgets. See how, you know, all the money we had at one point. Boy, it was quite something. And in the early years. And then, anyway, so this is a little context for this. But what I hope it leaves you with is the tremendous value of vision. Vision is an act of imagination. It's imagining a future that can be different. And rather than being oppressed by the future, and rather than, you know, being greedy or wanting or demanding or expecting and getting caught in it, we don't have to ignore the future and ignore the possibility of what the future can bring us, but we can have a vision of what's possible, an aspiration for what's possible, something we grow into, we develop into, we mature into, something that gets actualized, something gets expanded, that within us, and that kind of sense of vision can provide tremendous motivation for human life, and we can be motivated to bring out the best that's in us. And whenever I think the best in a human being comes forth, it's really supports everyone else as well. And I really do hope that the practice of meditation, of mindfulness, of Buddhism is done for the welfare and happiness of all beings. And so on Saturday afternoon, there was a part of the celebration where I was interviewed by Sylvie, wonderful interview. I thought it was fun to be interviewed. And so I said some of the stuff about vision then, and you know how this works. I forget how the conversation. You can listen to it. It's online now already, but I forget how it went because I wasn't listening to it. I don't remember. I was So she probably said something like, "Well, do you have any vision now, or something?" And or you know, how big is your vision, or something? And, well, I want to change the world now. Why stop? Why stop here? But you know, if I have enough millennia. Anyway, so the idea of a vision, and the last thing I'll say. There was a Zen teacher in America. He would sing these Frank Sinatra songs, and his favorite song was the one about to dream the impossible dream, and that somehow that represented for him the having a vision, having a possibility, and practicing for something that was impossible, but practicing towards that anyway. So a lot of things are possible, and a profound sense of peace and love and well-being and healing and sense of being deeply at home in our wonderful world with other people is possible. And it would be lovely if you step through all the many doors that are open for you to realize that for yourself. Great. Thank you.